United Press International presents 1967 in Review, a documentary in words and sounds of the events and the people who were the newsmakers during 1967. You'll hear the UPI Man and Woman of the Year and the Story of the Year on 1967 in Review. Few stories in 1967 demanded the coverage by news media, the space in newspapers, or the attention of the world, as did the six-day Middle East War. Since the birth of Israel in 1948, the Middle East has plodded its way into the second half of the 20th century with the sound of war. Three times in 20 years, the land of the Bible became a battleground. In comparison to the other two wars in the area, the war in 1967 was shorter, but no less spectacular, no less significant. It was on June 5th that war broke out between Israel and the Arab nations of Jordan, Syria, and the United Arab Republic.
War came to the Middle East today with stunning suddenness. Israel charged Egypt, launched the supplies, blitzkrieg with troops, tanks, and planes in the south near Gaza, and its own forces were counterattacking. Air raid alarms sounded in both Egypt and Israel, and Arab radios were reported here to be hailing the start of the long-awaited holy war against this country. This is Robert Musil in Tel Aviv.
The war in the Middle East did come with startling suddenness, but its inevitability was evident at the start of June. President Nasser of the UAR had seen to it that the United Nations Emergency Force no longer patrolled the Israeli-Arab border. United Nations Secretary General Utant made a futile trip to Cairo, trying desperately to avert war. The situation was aggravated by Nasser's announcement to close the Straits of Tehran and the Gulf of Aqaba to Israeli shipping. Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eban contended this was enough to start the war.
From May the 24th onward, the question who started the war or who fired the first shot became momentously irrelevant. There is no difference in civil law between murdering a man by slow strangulation or killing him by a shot in the head. From the moment at which the blockade was posed, active hostilities had commenced, and Israel owed Egypt nothing of her charter rights. If a foreign power sought to close Odessa or Copenhagen or Marseille or Montreal or New York Harbor by the use of force, what would happen? Would there be any discussion about whether a shot had been fired? Would anyone ask whether aggression had begun?
If you can say there was anything good about the war, maybe it was the fact that it lasted only 6 days. Israel's swift victory on all fronts and the acceptance of a United Nations ceasefire by the Arabs and Jews were responsible. For the Jews, the victory meant many things, but most of all it meant a return to the city of Jerusalem, the city of great religious significance to them. By the thousands, they went to the holy city to touch the wailing wall. The shofar's wail and the whisper of a thousand Jews in prayer were heard once more at the sacred spot. Israelis touched and hugged the wall, hoping that in some way more meaning would be added to their religious creeds. Then, in a moment of stirring patriotism, the Hatikva, the Israeli national anthem, was sung. Though the battlefields were quiet, the war was far from settled. Debate in the United Nations Security Council and General Assembly continued throughout the year with no important gains being made. A summit meeting in the tiny college town of Glassboro, New Jersey, between President Johnson and Soviet Premier Alexei Kosygin had little effect on the situation. But almost before the dust and smoke had settled in the desert battlefield, the big powers started to rearm the countries of the Middle East. The question left unanswered in 1967, will peace ever come to the Middle East? The United Press International 1967 in Review will continue after this message. As if the Middle East war wasn't enough for 1 year in that part of the world, the Greeks and Turks almost started another. Their dispute concerned the independent Mediterranean island of Cyprus. Half the size of New Jersey, this island country agreed to avert war just as war seemed imminent. The problem? The Greeks and Turks living on Cyprus just don't get along. Greece had more than its share of headlines this year. A military junta seized control of that country in a coup on April 21st. The coup came quickly, and it surprised many people, including this American woman who was in Athens.
I got up early this morning to go to the store to get oranges and eggs for breakfast. When I got to the corner of the street, this was about 8:30, a soldier presented arms and told me to go home. And so I said, I want to go to the store. He said, it's closed. Oh, I should say that he couldn't speak English, but he called someone who spoke a little. And I said, is this a demonstration of some kind? He said, perhaps something like that. So I went home, and we had cereal for breakfast.
The coup stemmed from a general feud among the political factions in Greece. The junta set up a committee to rewrite the constitution and made it clear they were not about to give up their power. President Charles de Gaulle of France visited Canada in Expo 67 during the summer. He was something less than a hit with the Canadian government when he uttered these words in Montreal.
La France entière sait, voit, entend ce qui se passe ici. Et je puis vous dire qu'elle en vaudra mieux. Vive Montréal, vive le Québec. Vive le Québec libre.
Those words, encouraging a sovereign state of Quebec in Canada, led to a quicker trip home for Le Grand Charles than he had planned. For Russia, 1967 was an anniversary year. They celebrated the 10th anniversary of Sputnik, and it marked their golden anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. As usual, their celebrations included a parade of their newest military machinery. But 1967 wasn't all celebration. Because they publicly supported the Arabs, their defeat in the Middle East was considered a blow to the Russians as well. Another stunning letdown to their prestige came in 1967 when this voice was heard on American radio and television.
Many people are surprised why, for instance, my mother was not very tender with me, but my father was described as a rather...
That was Svetlana Aliyeva, the daughter of Joseph Stalin. Svetlana was acclaimed Woman of the Year in a poll taken by UPI of newspaper editors and publishers. Her defection from Russia was the most startling since the Iron Curtain went up over 20 years ago. Coming up on 1967 in Review, this story.
Michigan State Police have just asked some of the men to quit firing because they're firing tracers right over our heads, as we are now all pinned down on the south side of Detroit.
Riots shattered American cities in 1967. United Press International looks back at the story of the year, the summer of unrest, next on 1967 in Review.
The summer is going to be a most difficult summer. I don't think that there's any city of any size in the United States that can really say that I'm going to be free of violence.
Unfortunately, the prediction made by Corps Director Floyd McKissick became reality. Dissatisfaction of Negroes with their way of life was cited as one of the prime causes of the riots. In some cases, outside agitators were suspected. But no matter, the summer of 1967 was violent. In Newark, Detroit, Milwaukee, and many other cities. The largest city in New Jersey, with over half the population Negro, exploded on the night of July 12th.
Firefight between National Guardsmen and a number of people in the...
It also happened in Detroit on July 23rd. The city was ablaze in the riot area with trembling fingers of flame lighting the black sky.
The crack of snipers' rifles continue as morning comes to Detroit. About 30 bright orange balls of flame along with belching black smoke herald the continued activity of arsonists, looters burning their stores behind them. Paratroopers ordered to the nation's fifth largest city by President Johnson are in armored vans rumbling through riot-torn sections of Detroit. I took my tape recorder to a number of gun battles in the city last night, and this is how it sounded.
Keeper Unit 1 calling radio. Put your lights out! Put your lights out!
Utter chaos is one way to describe the devastation in Detroit's inner city area.
And so it continued 7 days later in Milwaukee. For the cities where riots occurred, the total loss in dollars is estimated at over $600 million. But a bigger loss, 84 dead. After the week of rioting in Detroit, President Johnson addressed the nation.
I'm tonight appointing a special advisory commission on civil disorders. The commission will investigate the origins of the recent disorders in our cities. It will make recommendations to me, to the Congress, to the state governors, and to the mayors for measures to prevent or contain such disasters in the future.
Thoughtless looting, rioting, and killing made an ugly stain on the 1967 calendar of news. Many Negroes believe the cause is right in the ghetto where dirt and slums breed rats and hate.
They give us the projects, they give us nice homes, but they put the price up so high. And they charge us $100 a month to live in a house. Not only do we live in there, but here we got rats walking and opening up your front door. And if you look wrong at them, if you look wrong at the rats, they're going to jump right on you. They're eating up your babies, they're biting your babies. If I'm lying, you think I'm lying, I'll take you right over my house right now. Now, I have no rats over there. But you see the lady next door, and you see her baby. And that's wrong. That is not right.
And to some Negroes, like militant H. Rapp Brown, there is only one solution. He said it in Washington on July 27th.
You had better arm yourself because the man is ready, and he going to turn black policemen against you. You can no longer sit back. You better get yourself some guns, because if you don't, your sons and your daughters will have to get guns if they're still here.
United Press International's review of the news will continue after this message. Whether the riots and violence had any effect on civil rights legislation in 1967 is not certain. But civil rights legislation never did get off the ground except for a few minor programs. But the whole LBJ legislative program was challenged this year by Congress. And if we had to characterize the 90th Congress, we could say with a measure of credulity that it was one of revolt. For veteran politician Lyndon Johnson, the 90th Congress was a tough challenge. In fact, during his political life, no year has been as challenging as 1967. UPI's Duff Thomas reports.
The president's standing with the American people dropped to an all-time low. Summer riots, the lingering Vietnam War, and what was apparently disenchantment with Mr. Johnson's personality contributed to his drop in popularity. Congress balked at nearly every important LBJ legislative request, and he spent the last 6 months fighting in vain for a tax increase he said would retard an inflationary spiral. He met with his Vietnam lieutenants at Guam in the spring, went to Glassboro, New Jersey in the summer for a summit conference with Premier Alexei Kosygin of the Soviet Union. He would not announce his political plans for 1968, but revealed the style he might use in a race for re-election. He went on nationwide radio and TV in November and gave an impressive performance of a relaxed and confident president. He gave the hand of his daughter Linda in marriage to Marine Captain Charles Robb at a colorful holiday wedding in the White House. And despite his troubles in 1967, no knowledgeable political observer counted him out. United Press International picked the president as Man of the Year. Duff Thomas, the White House.
In 1967, the rift between Russia and Red China was intensified. And they made no attempt to hide the feud. Radio Moscow had this comment.
The Soviet Union has warned China that it reserves the right to take any retaliatory steps necessary unless China ensures the rights and safety of Soviet citizens.
Charges and countercharges between Peking and Moscow almost led to a break in diplomatic relations. If Mao lost any sleep in 1967, it was because of his country's internal unrest and not the feud with Russia. This unrest, which led to purges of Mao's dissenters, didn't help to get them into the United Nations this past year. Neither did the fact that they exploded their first hydrogen bomb. A move to seat them in the United Nations failed again. The move has failed since 1950. And while relations with the two giants of communism teetered, Russia and the United States took action to cement their relationship. Although there was stiff congressional opposition to it, a counselor treaty between Moscow and Washington was passed. A space treaty was agreed to by the United States, the Soviet Union, and 60 other nations. The treaty limits military activities in space. signing the Treaty for Russia at the White House was their ambassador, Anatoly Dobrynin.
Outer space presents a new great challenge to mankind. International cooperation in this field, on the basis of equality provided for in the treaty, will allow all countries to actively participate in the peaceful exploration and use of outer space.
The District Attorney of New Orleans, Louisiana, became an internationally known figure when he decided to launch his own investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy. District Attorney James Garrison tells why.
We began looking into the question of a possible role of individuals in the city of New Orleans with regard to what ended up as the assassination of President Kennedy. When I began studying, initially out of curiosity, some of the material written about the Warren Commission report.
Despite criticism from many sources, Garrison is determined to continue his investigation. Continuing, too, is the race to the moon. But the efforts by the United States and Russia came to a tragic halt early in 1967. This was the announcement from Cape Kennedy.
A fire broke out. There has been a fatality. We do not know who it is yet. We're waiting on word now from the Cape.
The complete story of space, tragedy, failure, success. Coming up next on United Press International's 1967 in Review. Man's intense desire to conquer the mysteries of space, to fly to the moon, to explore the universe, reached new dimensions in 1967. Partly because of successes, partly due to failure, and most assuredly because of tragedies. Everyone knew it would happen one day. Spaceman Virgil Gus Grissom knew.
My career has been serving a nation, serving a country, and here's another opportunity where they need my talent. And I'm most grateful for an opportunity to serve in this capacity.
But even when you know the inevitable will happen, it's still hard to prepare for. The nation was not prepared on January 27, 1967, when this announcement was made at Cape Kennedy.
There was a plug job test going on in spacecraft 204, Complex 34. A fire broke out. There has been a fatality. We do not know who it is yet. We're waiting on word now from the Cape. We do know that the prime crew is aboard and a fatality was on the spacecraft.
Three American astronauts were the victims of America's first space-oriented tragedy, in a capsule that never left the ground. Veteran spaceman Gus Grissom, spacewalker Ed White, and rookie Roger Chaffee. A flash fire in the Apollo capsule, combined with an escape hatch that wouldn't open fast enough, claimed their lives. The astronauts were nearing the end of a simulated space flight on the ground when one of them yelled.
The message from the crew notifying of the fire, I think we'll have to play back the tape as the board gets into action to have it precisely, but as it was reported from on-the-spot observers and those listening to the loop, was the word fire in the spacecraft, which was attributed to one of the crewmen.
That was Major General Sam Phillips, director of the Apollo program. An investigation showed that sloppy workmanship, poor inspection, and inadequate safety design led to the accident. 3 months later, the Soviet Union launched a manned spaceship, Soyuz 1. It was their re-entry into the space race after 2 years of not launching manned space vehicles. As usual, the Russians were jubilant, and their cosmonaut, Vladimir Komarov, sent greetings to them from space. The next day, after trouble developed with his spacecraft, Komarov prepared to return to Earth. Soyuz 1 tumbled into the Earth's atmosphere. Komarov deployed his main parachute, and its cords became twisted around the spacecraft. The parachute never opened. The cords around the capsule trapped the cosmonaut inside. Komarov died instantly as he was slammed into the crust of the Earth somewhere in Russia. United Press International's year review of the news will continue after this message. Despite the two tragedies, large leaps were made in 1967 by both Russia and the U.S. to obtain their goal of landing men on the moon. The United States placed 4 Surveyor spacecrafts on the moon. The first one dug a trench to test the lunar soil.
The first operations of the surface sampler on Surveyor 3 were to lower the sampler gently onto the surface and then push with an elevation motor. The sampler was actually pushed into the surface of the moon about an inch or an inch and a half.
By November, Surveyor 6 was on the moon. This report on the moon exploration was from the Jet Propulsion Laboratories in Pasadena.
Surveyor 6 was launched from the moon about 10 feet off the surface. The spacecraft landed again 8 feet from its original position. The spacecraft's rocket engines were fired at 2:32 a.m. Pacific Standard Time for 2.5 seconds at a thrust level of 150 pounds. Commands prepared here at JPL were sent from the Goldstone, California tracking station. Television pictures taken after the launching showed the original impressions in the lunar soil of surveyors' footpads made when the spacecraft landed on the moon November 9th. Between these impressions could be seen the effects of the exhaust from surveyors' small liquid rocket engines. This event marked the first rocket launching from the moon's surface.
But America's finest space accomplishment came on Thursday, November the 9th.
10, 9, ignition sequence start. 5,
there is ignition.
We have ignition.
Flames shooting from either side. But there it is. It's lifting. Slowly, agonizingly slowly, it seemed to lift from that path. Here it comes, that gigantic roar.
A brilliant sheet of flame, about 6 times longer than the 363-foot-tall rocket itself, is spewing from the 5 engines. It appears to still be going well, a tremendous tail of flame.
So with a roar like that of 1,000 jets, Saturn V, 36 stories high, 7,000 tons of steel and carrying inside the most sophisticated electronic gear, lifted slowly off the launch pad at Cape Kennedy. At the end of its successful journey, it had taken one more giant step toward the moon for America. Russia's space feat included a spacecraft that landed on Venus and a successful link-up in space, their first. While skydiving isn't exactly the same as walking in space, it can be as thrilling or as dangerous. Its danger was proven in 1967 when skydivers jumped out of a plane into a layer of clouds. When they broke through, they discovered to their horror that they were over water with no land in sight. The water was Lake Erie. 18 divers hit the water. Only 2 survived. One of them was Robert Coy of Springfield, Ohio.
No, sir, I don't think I will. I think after a tragedy like this coming so close to home, I don't think I'll ever have a desire to jump again.
Skydiving or even space soaring doesn't interest Helmut Winter of Munich, Germany. But in 1967, he was interested in low-flying planes, enough so to try to do something about them. George Lindsay reports from London.
The story of little Helmut Winter is being told and retold around Europe's dinner tables, and as the legend grows, Helmut's fame is becoming international. Helmut Winter will now have his soggy Bavarian dumplings enshrined in a Munich museum. He has also been singled out for the first award from the Carl Valentine's Museum, named after the German comedian. Helmut would probably never be known today if it hadn't been for low-flying U.S. and German aircraft over his home in Munich. Helmut was losing sleep, so he built a giant catapult, loaded them with soggy dumplings, and fired away. Not one hit their target. But the U.S. and German air forces gave in. Nowadays, they stay well out of range. Why has Helmut become Europe's hero of 1967? Well, like David killing Goliath, his story has all the ingredients of victory by the little men over giants.
From the Capitol, stories of congressional ethics, the economy, the elections, and presidential hopefuls kept a brisk pace for newsmen.
I recommend to the Congress a surcharge of 6% on both corporate and individual income taxes.
I don't think they have yet sold the American people or the Congress on the need for increased taxes.
I am out as a congressman. You no longer have a Congress.
If you want to get into a discussion about who's been brainwashing whom, I just suggest you take a look at what this administration's been telling the American people at home and abroad.
Oh, I think it's a wide-open thing, and I don't think any party's ever had a greater wealth of potential candidates, any number of which could do a very fine job.
The these stories will be heard next on UPI's 1967 in Review. The topic of inflation crept into every conversation that had to do with money in 1967. The president, recognizing the threat of inflation, asked Congress to do something about it early in the year. This was his State of the Union address.
I recommend to the Congress a surcharge of 6% on both corporate and individual income taxes to last for 2 years, or for so long as the unusual expenditures associated with our efforts in Vietnam continue.
That was in January. 7 months later, the president made another request. This time he requested not a 6%, but a 10% tax hike. The criticism that had been prevalent all during the year became bolder. The Republicans in the House and Senate were quick to take up the challenge. A strong critic all year was House Minority Leader Gerald Ford.
If we could only get some cooperation from the White House and the Johnson administration in the process of reducing non-military, non-essential spending, we could probably avoid the need and necessity for the tax increase that the administration apparently wants Congress to approve. I don't think they have yet sold the American people or the Congress on the need for increased taxes, particularly when the administration makes no visible effort to cut back on expenditures in those areas where I think we can defer or eliminate programs and expenditures.
Two persons backing the president's request were his economic advisor, Gardner Ackley, and Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Fowler. Fowler said,
"We know that the American taxpayer doesn't like to have his taxes increased, but looking at that same taxpayer as a consumer, as a wage earner, as a businessman, as a veteran living off of a fixed income, as an elderly person living off of a fixed income, those concerned with the problems today in the cities, we know that the worst thing, the worst alternative, would be the threat of inflation and the financial imbalance that would be created if we didn't have a tax increase."
But Lyndon Johnson did not get his tax increase during 1967. Wilbur Mills, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, told why the request was put aside this past year.
"It seems to me that the position we are in shows an increasing awareness on the part of the administration of the need for expenditure cuts. I think we're making progress, but I feel that we still have some distance to go. I have not seen as yet any evidence that we are currently in any demand-pull inflationary situation which requires immediate action."
While money matters are a major concern of most Americans, there is one segment of society that wants little to do with the green stuff. To show their disdain for money, a delegation of hippies visited the New York Stock Exchange and from the visitors' gallery showered the floor of the exchange with dollar bills. That scene will never be repeated, for a new look at the exchange is a visitors' gallery with a bulletproof glass wall. Congressional ethics, elections in 67, and candidates for president in 68 will be heard next on the UPI review of the news right after this message. For Adam Clayton Powell, congressman from Harlem, 1967 started dreadfully and got worse. Powell was being investigated for possible misuse of public funds when the year was new. His position as chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee was taken away during the investigation, and he was refused a seat in the House during that time. While Powell encouraged his followers to keep the faith, baby, his financial activities were investigated, and on March the 1st, he was expelled from the House of Representatives.
"I want to say that today you have marked, in my opinion, the end of the United States of America as the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Yeah! More words of wisdom, please, brother.
And for you white faces out there, the same thing can happen to you or your brother.
In June, Senator Thomas Dodd of Connecticut was censured by the Senate. In his case, he was charged with using political funds for personal benefit. Some city and state elections in 1967 proved significant. Both in Cleveland, Ohio, and Gary, Indiana, a Negro was elected mayor. Carl Stokes, the mayor-elect of Cleveland, became the first Negro elected to head one of the 10 biggest cities in the United States.
I can find no more fitting way to end this appeal by saying to all of you, in the most serious and in the most meaningful way that I can, that truly never before have I ever known, to the extent that I know tonight, the full meaning of the word, God bless America. Thanks all.
In San Francisco, voters had a chance to vote yes or no on a question concerning Vietnam. The referendum asked if voters approved of an immediate ceasefire and withdrawal of troops from Vietnam. They voted no, 2-1. Vietnam will be a major issue in the 1968 presidential campaign. Already the contest is beginning to take shape. The first declared candidate was veteran politician Harold Stassen. Next was Michigan Governor George Romney.
I have decided to fight for and win the Republican nomination and election to the presidency of the United States.
On the Democratic side of the ledger, Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota announced he would oppose President Johnson's expected bid for the presidential nomination, running as an outright peace candidate.
My decision to challenge the president's position and the administration's position has been strengthened by recent announcements out of the administration, the evident intention to escalate and to intensify the war in Vietnam, and on the other hand, the absence of any positive indications or suggestions for a compromise or for a negotiated political settlement.
There was plenty of speculation about who else would enter the race. Many of the possibles, however, weren't talking. Richard Nixon.
As far as my own decision is concerned, however, I have not made a decision and will not make one for some time to come.
Charles Percy.
I do not consider myself a candidate. I am not a candidate. I do not intend to be a candidate. I will do nothing to become a candidate.
Ronald Reagan.
And I have told you repeatedly that I'll discourage anyone. I won't do anything to encourage it. I'll certainly not show up any place in campaign.
Nelson Rockefeller.
It just happens that I'm not a candidate, and under no circumstances will I be a candidate.
George Wallace.
One of the national parties do not give the American people a choice, and not only candidates, but also the platform. Then I'm going to be a candidate.
And?
Are you going to run next year?
I'll cross that bridge when I get to it, as I've told you so many times, Mr. Abbott.
Even some non-politicians got into the non-candidate act.
What are your politics? Are you a Democrat?
No, I'm a master of ceremonies.
You're not running for a public office?
No, I'm just running.
But whoever the candidates, one thing is sure, they will talk about Vietnam. And that topic is next on United Press International's 1967 in Review.
I want more than any human being in all the world to see the killing stopped.
It should be clear by now that the bombing of the North cannot bring an end to the war in the South.
I saw about 6 bombs go off right amongst the 2 buildings that we were after.
This is Bill Riley in Da Nang, Vietnam, and I'll be back in a moment with a look at a South Vietnamese presidential rally.
We will negotiate without conditions, or we will negotiate about conditions, or that we will discuss the final settlement.
This is part of what Vietnam was all about in 1967. First, there were increased and expanded air attacks on North Vietnamese targets by U.S. planes.
The main target for this morning's strike was the Long Son Railroad Bridge, about 10 miles south of the Chinese border. When I pulled off of my target, I looked back and observed the anti-personnel bombs going off all through the targets that I had been aiming for, and some had even spread out into another flak site over to the west. So I think we probably got one and damaged another.
In Washington, the bombing was cause for debate by the Hawks and the Doves and everyone else. Senator Robert Kennedy of New York said the bombings didn't accomplish anything.
Certainly the bombing of the North makes the war more costly and more difficult and more painful for North Vietnam. It is a harsh punishment indeed. But we are not in Vietnam to play the part of an avenging angel pouring death and destruction on the roads and the factories and the homes of a guilty land. We are there to assure the self-determination of South Vietnam, to fight the war effectively, and to protect as many lives as we can. It should be clear by now that the bombing of the North cannot bring an end to the war in the South, and indeed, at the present time, it may well be prolonging that war.
As in past years, this year there were many suggestions on how and why the war should be ended, why the United States should or shouldn't be involved. The United States offered several peace proposals in 1967. To all of them, Hanoi replied, no.
Our policy in Vietnam is the same. We are there to deter aggression. We are there to permit to the people of South Vietnam to determine for themselves who their leaders should be and what kind of a government they should have. It is remarkable that a young country fighting a tough war on its own soil has moved so far, so fast, toward a representative government.
Elections were held in September in South Vietnam. President Johnson sent observers, including New Jersey Governor Richard Hughes.
I had occasion to talk to people in the armed services, some from New Jersey, and the same answer came back from everyone. No fraud, no duress, no pressure from the police or military authorities, and the mechanical propriety of the election would have been evident to a blind man.
Elected president and vice president, respectively, were Nguyen Van Thieu and Nguyen Cao Ky. Back in Washington, a problem. We'll have that story after this message. The passage of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1964 gave the president the authority to do what he thinks is necessary to maintain peace and security in Vietnam. In 1967, some congressmen thought Johnson was overstepping that authority. Senator Clifford Case of New Jersey said,
only recently, on August 18th, the president told his news conference, I believe that every congressman and most of the senators knew what the Tonkin Gulf Resolution said. That resolution, the president went on, authorized the president and expressed the Congress's willingness to go along with the president to do whatever was necessary to deter aggression. But this, in my judgment, is a complete distortion of what Congress understood and what Congress intended by its action 3 years ago. It amounts to a claim by the president that we gave him a perpetual letter of credit, which no Congress could or would do.
The drama of Vietnam remained in the reports from the battlefield. Whether it was the swampy delta, the highlands, the lowlands, the bug-infested jungle, or Hill 875, the story was the same, one of courage and death. The number of Americans who gave their lives in Vietnam rose to over 15,000 in 1967. The dollar cost rose, too, $80 million a day. However, with an inspiring victory at the end of the year at a place called Doc Tho and Hill 875, General William Westmoreland, U.S. commander in Vietnam, predicted the end of the war was in sight.
We have reached an important point when the end begins to come into view. In Phase 3 in 1968, we intend to do the following. Help the Vietnamese armed forces to continue improving their effectiveness. Continue pressure on the North to prevent rebuilding and to make aggression more costly.
Early in 1967, Henry Cabot Lodge left his position as ambassador to Vietnam and was replaced by veteran diplomat Ellsworth Bunker. An administrative change that will have an effect on American policy in Vietnam came later in the year.
About the middle of October, I was informed by the president that nominations to succeed Mr. Wood would soon have to be made, and the president asked me if I was still interested in serving as head of the bank. I answered in the affirmative, repeating, however, that I would not leave the post of Secretary of Defense until the president felt he could release me.
Robert Strange McNamara, and held the post of Secretary of Defense for 7 years, longer than any secretary before him. Some prominent persons passed away in 1967, among them German statesman Konrad Adenauer, former British Prime Minister Clement Attlee, actress Jane Mansfield, poet Carl Sandburg, Cuban revolutionist Che Guevara, former Vice President John Nance Garner, and France's Cardinal Spellman. One man was given a second chance to live. To him, the most important sound in the world is the beat of a heart that lived for 22 years inside another person. Now that heart is his. The first successful heart transplant was performed in South Africa on December the 2nd. Louis Weshkansky had his heart traded for that of a 22-year-old woman who was killed in an automobile accident. The operation was performed by Dr. Christian Barnard.
Patient's circulation is improving all the time. He's now not artificially ventilated anymore. His heart is not being stimulated by an electrical machine. He's completely on his own, conscious, and so far doing very well.
So a new era in medical history was reached in 1967 with the first successful heart transplant. And so it was in fashion with shorter miniskirts and mod clothes. So it was with the young generation as they experimented more and more with narcotics and drugs, LSD and marijuana. So it was for dissenters and protesters.
Hell no, we won't go! Hell no, we won't go! Peace now! Peace now! Peace now! Peace now!
Next we'll look at the dissenter. The protester in the year 1967, as this review of the year's news by United Press International continues.
Mayor Johnson said this week in New England that I had been a protester all my life, and I have been. Protesting the status quo, protesting illiteracy, protesting poverty, protesting ignorance, protesting inadequate treatment of all of our citizens, in unequal opportunities for all of our people. And by protesting, we have done something about them.
1967 may be remembered as a year of protest. There were protest demonstrations not only in the United States cities, but in Peking, London, Moscow, Jakarta, Tokyo, Saigon, and Paris. In fact, most major cities of the world were the scene of demonstrations of one kind or another. In the United States, the demonstrations most often concerned Vietnam, the draft, and civil rights. The first large nationwide demonstration was held on April 15th. It was booked as an anti-Vietnam War protest. But as was often the case in 67, the demonstration embraced those who had things to say about civil rights and the draft, too.
I have not urged a mechanical fusion of the civil rights and peace movements. There are people who have come to see the moral imperative of equality, but who cannot yet see the moral imperative of world brotherhood. I would like to see the fervor of the civil rights movement imbued into the peace movement to instill it with greater strength. And I believe everyone has a duty to be in both the civil rights and peace movements. But for those who presently choose but one, I would hope they will finally come to see the moral roots common to both.
Martin Luther King was joined in New York City that day by Stokely Carmichael.
The draft exemplifies as much as racism the totalitarianism which prevails in this nation in the disguise of consensus democracy. The president has conducted war in Vietnam without the consent of Congress or of the American people, without the consent of anybody except maybe Lady Bird. In fact, the war itself is for the birds, Lady Bird, Lyndon Bird, and Lucy Bird.
Hubert Humphrey gave his view of dissent in April.
Recognizing that debate and discussion and dissent at times are distracting and disturbing. Nevertheless, the answer, the best answer to the communist, the best answer to the totalitarian, is the fact that we do permit intellectual freedom, academic freedom, freedom of the press, freedom of dissent, freedom of discussion. I think all Americans need to keep in mind that there's a great deal of difference between dissent and being irresponsible. But I think most Americans do.
The protesters and dissenters weren't the only ones who marched in 1967. There were parades and demonstrations supporting U.S. action in Vietnam and the soldiers fighting there.
Just a few moments ago, I spoke to someone who was carrying the NFL flag. I see that you're carrying an American flag. How do you feel about those who are displaying the flag of the Viet Cong?
Well, this is my flag. That may be their flag, but this is my flag, and I love it, so I carry it, and I wave it. I'm not going to burn it, spit on it. It's mine. Somebody tried to take it away from me, and I'd fight them to take it away from me.
Our activities tomorrow were planned quite some time ago. The request only got into a real high gear in the last few days. Our activities are nationwide. We have urged everyone, every place, to turn the lights of their car on during Saturday and Sunday. We've asked them to turn the lights on if they're driving a truck or a bus or a taxi cab or a motorcycle. And we're asking them to leave a light burning all night, a visible night light in their homes, apartments, places of business on Saturday night. We are not trying to counter anything except a wrong image of this country. And to the extent that the people of this country show their feeling, we feel that we will have achieved our purpose.
One of the best organized and largest demonstrations of the year was the March on the Pentagon on October the 21st. Like other demonstrations during the year, this one was not without incident.
The crowd finally broke up through, coming around the mall entrance, and now are charging at the very entrance of the Pentagon. The police are locked into a small portico where the doors are still open. Troops are now pouring out.
United Press International Review of the 1967 news will continue right after this message. Yes, the year was filled with sit-ins, march-ins, love-ins, and even this at the White House. Could it be a quack-in?
A different bird at the White House today. We thought we had seen every kind of demonstration on Pennsylvania Avenue, but today, a group of Long Island ducks led by housewives picketed to protest a proposed atomic power plant at Riverhead, Long Island. The ladies represent a group called the Fact Finders, who feel that atomic reactors near homes threaten the health and safety of the community. As one lady told us,
slogan is, we don't want radioactive ducks. We like our ducks on Long Island.
They carried signs saying, down with atomic quackery and you can't duck radioactive waste. This is Duff Thomas at the White House.
A less noisy and somewhat more sophisticated type of protest demonstration is the strike. 1967 had those, too. The United Auto Workers struck the Ford Motor Company for almost 2 months, and some of the prettiest strikers of all time were the bunnies from the Playboy Club. The Rockettes at Radio City Music Hall did their high-kicking out in the street for 3 weeks as they struck the hall for higher pay and for better working conditions. 1 million school children in New York City had an extended summer vacation when their teachers chose to strike for 17 days. Some students, however, demonstrated right back. They wanted to get on with school. They wanted teachers.
We want teachers! We want teachers! We want teachers!
1967 was quite a year. In the Midwest, it will be remembered as the year of the 67 blizzard. In Long Beach, California, the year the Queen Mary came to stay. In Washington, D.C., the year of the wedding.
We are very happy this morning, Ms. Johnson and I, to welcome all of you here to the East Room of the White House. This is the poor man's wedding chapel. That's one of the fringe benefits of the presidency. You can have a wedding here in the house, and no one in the country really thinks it's cheap. Actually, we decided to have the wedding here because of one of my most recent experiences in the church.
Been listening to the United Press International 1967 in Review. This program was written, produced, and directed by Stan Savick. Technical director was Penn Stevens, and your narrator has been Ed Cairns. 1967 in Review was a United Press International audio production.